Welcome to Season 4 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we're speaking to some of the most innovative minds in the world of sports nutrition. We'll be discussing everything from research, practice, and performance to give you an inside look into the exciting world of combat sports performance. Today, my guest is Dean Amersinger. Dean is the Director of MMA at the UFC Performance Institute in Shanghai, China. Dean, alongside the other staff of specialists at the PI, are responsible for coordinating the development of the academy athletes who are part of the Performance Institute team. Dean has an undergraduate degree in nutritional biochemistry, is a former professional fighter himself, appearing on The Ultimate Fighter Season 9, UK vs. USA. He also coached on the Ultimate Fighter Smashers series and has coached athletes such as Ross Pearson, Dan Hardy, Michael Bisping, and Paul Daly. His experience also extends as an SNC coach with the Queensland Reds, Kubota Spears, and England Rugby. In this episode, we discuss Dean's own MMA career, his coaching career, how he came to be working at the UFC PI, and how his team coordinate and develop the academy athletes. There's a lot to get through, so let's get to it. All right, green light means we are live, so back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Now today, joined by another very special guest. We've got Mr. Dean Amersinger joining us from Canada. Everyone from the UFC PI Shanghai seems to be a bit spread out around the world, but coming from Canada, Dean, thanks for coming on, mate.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, mate. We had a little bit of trouble getting it sorted with the time difference and whatnot, but glad to be here, mate. I enjoy the episodes you put out. I enjoy the podcast.
Yeah, appreciate it. Yeah, clocks are not my strong point, that's for sure. But Dean, how's things been going? Obviously, the world's a bit crazy at the moment with COVID and everything, and China is obviously, you guys weren't allowed to go back in. What's happening on that front for you guys? You're just a little bit spread out everywhere, or how's it happening?
Yeah, so it's been a crazy few months, to be honest. We were shutting down for Chinese New Year anyway, because that's the most important holiday in China. It's like their Christmas, and the country pretty much shuts down for about 2 weeks. So we were sending the athletes back home, and you know, some of them hadn't even been home in the first 6 months that they'd been with us. So they were going, you know, all around China, because the athletes that are part of the academy are from all over. And so in that time, I was planning on having my eldest daughter, who lives back in the UK, to come back to come to China and visit with my mum. But at that time, everything was just really, obviously looking back on it, we now know how serious it was going to get. But at the time, it was like, it was serious, but you weren't really sure what was going on. But then like Disney World shut, and you know, the Great Wall of China and things that we had planned, you know, for that trip. So my wife and I and my youngest daughter, we were just like, nah, we want to get out of here. And at that time, everyone was kind of home anyway for Chinese New Year in terms of the expat staff in Shanghai. So I went to Thailand and then had the holiday there. But then the border was basically effectively shut by the end of that holiday. So I've been out of China, packed for what I thought was going to be like a 2 week holiday in Thailand. And I've been out of the country since basically the beginning of February. And so I ended up being in Thailand for a month. But that was actually really good. And I turned that into like a professional development situation, and I, you know, visited AKA Tiger, Phuket top team. I got, you know, had good conversations with the coaches and the program there, and talked about what we're doing and build a relationship there, because obviously they've got guys that are in the UFC. So, you know, saying that they're as a resource, and they're able to use what we have in Shanghai, either remotely or visiting. So it was actually a really productive trip, and then ended up going to Vegas and stayed probably another month there. And that was also really good, because you know, we had hoped to have a full sort of team gathering where the whole Shanghai group would be in Las Vegas. But logistically, that would be quite difficult, obviously, while we're operational, you know, stopping things. So it was going to be like smaller groups to make sure that we're working together. So that was also a silver lining in terms of getting everyone together, seeing how the operations go. And it just so worked out that I think it was when Izzy fought, that what UFC was that? Was that 248?
Yeah, 248, yeah. I think. Yeah,
248. So that coincided with us being there. So he saw the operations around a fight week in Las Vegas, which is also good to, you know, be a part of and see, you know, how the PI operates under those circumstances. That was really cool. And then just, you know, with our respect, each department has a respective counterpart from Shanghai to Las Vegas. So it was really good to be working as a team together in that way, and have, you know, opening up conversations and moving things forward. And then Vegas effectively also went into lockdown, and my wife's Canadian, so I ended up coming to Canada. So since like end of March, I've been here in Canada, and it's looking like China's not, you know, at the moment we don't really know, but the borders are pretty much shut probably till October time. So you know, the expat staff aren't going to be able to go then, but we're definitely going to be opening before then. But that's, you know, to be, you know, TBC in terms of when exactly that happening, but we'll open up with a non-full staff sort of skeleton staffing, and then just get the guys back into it and get them going.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure if anyone can make this work in the world, if there's one company, it's going to be the UFC, and we've seen that time and time again.
Exactly. We want to be first back to it, really. And so we're going to make that happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Dean, let's wind back a little bit and let's talk about before you got back with the UFC PI. You're a former professional fighter yourself, and you were on the Ultimate Fighter season. I think if we've got diehard fans listening in, that they'll recognize you from that. Tell us about that series. Can you talk to us about how you got involved with the Ultimate Fighter, what it was like in there, and how that led into your career now?
Yeah, well, it's a funny one, because basically I've been around the sport for a long time, and I was fortunate. I went to university in Nottingham, to the University of Nottingham, I'd been involved in martial arts most of my life, kind of started when I was like 4 years old, and then I was at a gym, and it was like just a weights gym, and then there was a guy hitting a bag in the gym, and so I just went up to him and said, "Oh, you look like you're training, you know, kickboxing, whatever. Where are you doing it?" And that was Paul Daly, and he said, "I'll come down. We train this day and that day. Come and get involved." And it was literally just in a sports hall. No, it wasn't even a sports hall. It was like a community center with a wooden floor, and like Bisping was there, Dan Hardy, and Paul Daly, and there was a guy called Paul Davis who was kind of running that. And it was, there was a few other guys at like Cage Warrior level, and they're already fighting. And I just got involved, and I'd been wrestling for, since I was sort of 12 years old. And it's something that is the basis of pretty much my style. And, historically England hasn't had the best wrestlers. So as a training partner, even before I was going to go into them, I was still at university at this time. But I was a good training partner for them because I could wrestle, and so I just carried on training and getting involved with them. And then Bisping left, went to Wolfslayer, and that's really when Roughhouse started to form. And we had like Jimmy Wallhead join, Andre Winner, Nico Shipshack, Ross Pearson, and the team really started to build out. And we are super fortunate that we had all these guys that were of a good level, but they were either lightweight or welterweight. So we had all these guys in the gym, and we didn't really have trainers, and we had individual trainers. We had no MMA coaches. We just had, we'd go and do our, Thai boxing here. We'd go to jiu-jitsu at a jiu-jitsu club. And then we'd meet twice a week and basically fight each other. But when you have that many guys that are of that level, it was just like, the cliche of iron sharpens iron. And it was a really good environment. And then at one point, we had, seven guys from one gym in the UFC, and we went 5-0 on a UFC in one night, and UFC 105 in Manchester. We went 5-0, which is pretty crazy for it. Yeah. And then with Tough, as that was just, they had the trials in the UK, everyone went down there. It was like, everyone in the UK scene was pretty much there. And you go through the sort of, initial sort of interview process, but then there was the fight to get onto the show, and that was a pretty crazy experience as well, because there's a guy called Alex Reed who you probably wouldn't know, but in the UK, he at that time he was actually the first live MMA event I went to, which was a Cage Rage. He fought Lee Murray, which is also probably a fighter you might know. Lee Murray, the guy who was involved in that £60 million heist, and he's now in prison in Morocco, and he fought, he had that notorious fight with Tito Ortiz on the street, guy. Yeah. So Lee Murray and him are fighting. That was the first live MMA event I went to. And then, a couple of years later, I was fighting him to get onto the Ultimate Fighter. So that was like a real surreal experience for me. But then he later went on to be He was, had this celebrity girlfriend, and he was all in the, tabloids and whatnot. And most people would know me for fighting him, because rather than anything else, sort of thing. But and then in that time, I knew Bisping, and from that time we used to train before he went to Wolfslayer. But then really we reconnected on the Ultimate Fighter and actually became friends and went through that process on the Ultimate Fighter, which was. Again, really, having this quarantine now and that, being in a confined space, obviously it's different, but it's similar to that, because you're not allowed music, you're not allowed books, things that are part of your normal routine that you, to make you feel comfortable or whatever, that's all not there. So it creates a pressure pot of living in a house with people that are your competition, that you don't know, different culture, being, America to England. And, with all the English guys, historically on the Ultimate Fighter, the guys from all over, and the teams don't really mean anything. But because it was UK versus America, we were really bound by the fact that it was, for starters, three of us were on the same team, Ross, myself, and Andre, and then Nika Shipshak as well. So four of the eight were from one team, Roughhouse. So we already knew each other. And then the other guys, because the UK scene wasn't that big, we also, you know guys from around the events, and do you know what I mean? So we were really close. And I feel that gave us an advantage in that whole experience. But even at that time, when I look back on it, I ended up cornering every person in their fights in the Ultimate Fighter. And like moving on, to later in career, like I fought on events where I fought on an event and cornered people either late before or after me, which looking back on it as a coach is just like such a crazy, like stupid thing to do. But at the time it was a hard thing to admit to myself when I reflect back that I preferred coaching to fighting. Although I enjoyed fighting, my ego at the time didn't want to admit to myself that I had an aptitude for coaching and that was what I was better at. And I even back in the day with the Roughhouse, when I didn't really have the experience to be doing it, I was cornering guys in the UFC when I didn't have the coaching experience. I just sort of learnt on the job. Did my best to do my research and my experience from other sports that I was involved in, and that's kind of how I decided to quit. I was already always had one foot into coaching. It was a natural progression looking back on it that I was always going to end up in that way.
Was there a particular point that comes to your mind when that was really solidified in your mind, when you're like, okay, maybe the coaching route is more for me, more so than the athlete route?
Well, I was also a coach on the Ultimate Fighter team's Tough Smashes, which was Australia versus England, and Ross was the head coach. But obviously, Ross Ross is the head coach, but in terms of the face of it. But really, I ran the whole thing, because I was Ross's coach and I was the coach, right? So that was like the first time that. It was like I ran a full-time training program where all the athletes were there. We could organize everything, and I could put into practice some of the things that I had as a theory that I've got from other sports, like working in rugby and working in Olympic sports, and my experience from professional sport and some in terms of periodization and recovery and things like that. And so I was trying to implement that during Tough Smashes, and the UK guys really responded well to it, and I realized how beneficial some of those things would be, because they aren't implemented in MMA, but they certainly weren't at that time, and the training was so sporadic, and people even when we were fighting the UFC with Dan and fighting GSP, Dan and I would do a lot of training together, especially for that GSP fight. Because of my wrestling and whatnot, but we're traveling an hour to go to S&C, we're traveling an hour to go to jiu-jitsu, we're traveling nothing was centralized, and so your recovery is impacted, you're trying to, there's compromises in terms of what sessions, in terms of like vertical integration of training, that's like almost an impossible concept to implement during when those restrictions are there from the travel and then coordination between coaches in terms of every coach wants to give 100, you give 100%, and so whereas when I did the Tough Smashes, I was able to be in control of that, of like when the daily undulation of load management and so forth, and that was when I really was like, I think I could probably do this but having, trying to make it happen. And then I had my gym back in the UK, and that was starting to go well, and it kind of like the generation of fighters that I sort of cut my teeth on, which is like, although Paul Daly is still going now, but all of those guys are pretty much retired, and so I had to like restart with a a lot of guys, like my brother, who's doing really well in Cage Warriors, and then that sort of generation that are coming up, you know, started a few guys from amateur all the way to, you know, there's one guy, Terry Brazy, who's now fighting in Bellator. He was Bama two-weight world champion, but he, you know, I took him from his first punch, you know, walking into the gym into a world champion. So it was like it was another process of like restarting that group, and I moved back down to Windsor, which is where I'm originally from, and then that's where I really sort of established myself as a coach, and had this opportunity arise with the PI.
Yeah, let's talk about that, Dean. Let's go. How did that come about, and how did you find that transition going into from that environment into the PI environment?
Yeah, well, it's similar to my experience with Tough Smashes. I was able to, you know, implement things that I'd had a, you know, theory for how I would want to run a, you know, a professional program for mixed martial arts or a high performance program, where I'd always had to make, even at the highest level when I worked with Bisping and for his, you know, his world title fights and whatnot, there's still an element of although it was a well-run program, it was still an element of compromise because he still didn't have a centralized training place. Although he had a main place at Ruka, there was still some traveling involved, and there was still, you know, some of his coaches weren't full-time and so forth. So there's still compromise even at that level. And then I had a theoretical approach of how I would like to run MMA, and I'd had that even before I had did my interview, but I presented that in my interview when I was going through that process to get the job. And I think obviously that was a large part of me, of why I got the job, because I had already had an idea in place of how I would run a high performance facility. And that largely came from my experience working in professional rugby, and seeing how you know, there's different positions needing different needs, which is almost like comparative to different styles needing different needs, different weight classes, different needs in terms of their training, and how you periodize between, you know, pre-seasons like our off camp and in season, although obviously a lot longer, is like, you know, like a fight camp, and how the approach to training and the different attributes that you might work on in those particular phases, how they either complement each other or build into one another. So I took a lot from rugby and the other sports that I worked in, and how I would apply that to MMA. And then it was just a case of, once we got into it, and the team that you know, Duncan has assembled in, and James and Forrest in Shanghai, I've said to them multiple times how well they did in terms of that, not just in terms of the individual skill sets they have in their respective departments, but also the dynamics of the team and the way that we gel together and how well we get on with each other, and our skills complement each other. And we had a really fortunate situation when we got there. So we arrived like sort of March time, April time, and there were still some visa issues. And actually the PI had some, you know, in terms of the building, there were some delays and whatnot. So there was a period of time, maybe like two months, where we didn't have the athletes in, but we were there every day at the PI. And I had conversations in that time about MMA that I've never had in my life, like in terms of our approach. And we felt like we had a blank sheet of paper. Like very often when you think about even the high-end gyms, there's still restrictions in terms of they have class times, they have you know, there's a business model to adhere to, that sometimes you have to be considerate of in terms of when those sessions are and whatnot, and why certain things are done. And everything I'd done in MMA and what we were doing, I asked the question, why are we doing those things? And we all ask those questions about why, and there's certain things that have come from traditional martial arts that you might not even question, because it's what your coach did, and you know, in terms of like how many times you're sparring, or there's so many things you could think of. But everything we sort of reverse engineered and tried to reason, right, if we're going to be doing something, we know why we're doing that. And it, obviously there's many ways to skin a cat, but at least we've come to a justification in terms of a thought process as a group about why we're doing the particular things that we've chosen to do. And so that's been, that was one of my, you know, favorite times of this whole experience, was those conversations that we were having that I've never had I've never broken down MMA in that way, because you're just like in a bubble of going forward and forward and forward. And although, yeah, you have some pockets of interesting conversations with different coaches and so forth, we just never had such a dedicated time with those minds, including, you know, for some of that period, Duncan and Bo and Forrest, they were all there as well for that opening period. And it was just like, you know, a crescendo in terms of greater than the sum of our parts of all that brain power coming together around MMA from the experience that they had in with what they've had from Vegas and the time that they've accumulated that data and their experience of working with the UFC fighters. But then independently are some fresh perspectives with people like Gav, who hadn't worked in MMA, or and then Reed, who's a specialist who has, and then myself, Richie, and the MMA department, who have an experience in the sport at the highest level. And it was just, yeah, an incredible thing to be a part of, and I'm, you know, massively grateful for the for being a part of it, but also for the team around me. It's been amazing.
Hey guys, quick interruption here, but well worth it. You guys know that I work with a lot of fighters at world-renowned City Kickboxing, and if you've ever been to CKB, you'll notice that almost all the fighters are wearing Engage fight wear. I'm talking everyone. They're all wearing Engage gloves, shinies, headgear, shirts, shorts, and even slides. When I say everyone, I'm talking guys like middleweight champ Israel Adesanya, featherweight champ Alexander Volkanovski, lightweight champ-to-be Dan Hangman Hooker, Kai Kara France, Brad Riddell, and Shane Young. They're all wearing Engage, and they're all wearing it because the gear is not like any other fight gear you would have used before. The gear is custom-made with top-quality material and is by far the most stylish gear you'll see on the mats. So you can see for yourself, Engage has sorted my listeners out with a 10% discount code. All you need to do is apply TFD10 on checkout so you can see why everyone is repping Engage. All right, back to the show.
And let's go into that, Dean. How do you, because obviously you guys have the academy structure, so you've got these guys almost full-time training there. It's not so transient as the Las Vegas headquarters. How do you go about structuring the training at the academy, and what does the training look like for these guys?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, it is different. Obviously, it's similar in the way that everything that the Vegas PI offers, we offer. So any UFC fighter, any of your guys, or anyone from anywhere, obviously, we're assuming that from that Asia Pacific is going to, that region is going to probably utilize it more. But we have had fighters come in and do their camp there, especially obviously when we had the Shenzhen event and so forth. But in terms of the academy model, yeah, we've recruited 36 athletes from around China, some of the best guys from the domestic scene. And then, and they're there full time. They live in accommodation just off site. And then all their training is organized through us. And we obviously keep involved their coaches, and we have a good relationship with their coaches that they're from the gyms that they're originally from. But while they're with us, which is 90% of the time, that we're in control of their training. So principally, I have a system based on, or we have a system, sorry, based on identifying their skill set, whether it be on the technical side, because I separate the MMA fighter into three different characteristics. So the martial artist, the fighter, and the athlete. And so the martial artist is like the technical components, and there's several things that are in that list. I'm not going to go into them. There's like 10 in each section. The fighter side is more the, as a summary, is more the mental components, courage, toughness, that side of the spectrum. And then the athlete side is obviously more on the strength and conditioning aspect, or non-technical training, and more like the physical characteristics, like aerobic capacity and that side of things, strength, power, those sort of factors. So once there's a diagnostic assessment of their technical ability and their physical ability, and also the mental side takes longer to assess, because you really need to see them fighting to know those type of characteristics and see them spar. But you can get a technical assessment of them. And so we had Duncan put together an incredible assessment based around like what the NFL combine is like, but it's an MMA combine. So the same sort of ideas of some physical tests as well as some technical tests, and to create a picture of where their strength and weaknesses are. And then as we developed forward, getting a better understanding and separating the technical aspects into key areas like wrestling offense, defense, transition, striking offense, defense, cage work, all these different aspects, and creating a picture. And then I have a core timetable, which is the martial arts that we've established off in terms of the data that we have of what it takes to win, and the areas where the most common areas where fights take place. That core timetable is a competency or a level that every athlete should have, MMA athlete should have, regardless of their style. And then there are other sessions available in that timetable that are then for either, depending if they're in off camp, which would be a more focus on their weaknesses, you would look to develop, obviously in terms of an emphasis, not just the blanket sheet working on their weaknesses, but in terms of emphasis, they'll be working on aspects, and then as we go into fight camp, they're working on their strengths, and that will be based off that initial assessment that you have of the athlete. So that core time, where the whole academy does together, and that's shared in terms of their training cover, you know, covering all the aspects of mixed martial arts, and then specializing in the other sessions that you have over the week, dependent on the needs of the athlete. And that also applies to the non-technical training as well, because there may be particular characteristics they need to be working on from the data that comes from the diagnostics.
Hey Dean, did you find that there was like a particular style that the Chinese fighters were adhering to? Like, you always hear a lot about, say, like the Russians are really heavy wrestlers and really good wrestlers. And same with a lot of the US guys, or I know down my part of the world, say the Kiwis, the New Zealand guys are really getting renowned for being really good strikers. Mm. Were there particular attributes for these Chinese athletes that, hey, they were, say, more jiu-jitsu practitioners or strikers, or was it a real mixed bag, or what did you guys find?
We found that there was definitely a mix, but the main striking martial art is Sanda, which is like a form of kickboxing. So they've got really good kicks, which is the main martial art that Zhang Weili came from. But they're, in terms of their boxing, it's not quite as developed in terms of the, you know, probably the defensive boxing is not generally as good, and then we have a lot of wrestlers as well. So we have a number of guys that were in the national team for wrestling, that sort of level wrestler, or a provincial wrestling, which is still, like, you know, in American version would be like state level, you know, competitor in, like, so we have a varying spread between those two, and then we have, you know, other styles as well, but the two most represented would be wrestling and Sanda. And then in terms of where they are as a group, I'd say they're slightly behind where the rest of the world is in terms of putting everything together. That's what they're definitely missing, is those transitions, which is the highest level really of where the sport is going. The difference really comes from how well people transition between the varying martial arts and thinking, and as a concept, trying to think much more in terms of MMA as the martial art, rather than separating those things out, which is in terms of terminology, the way we need to move forward and conceptually be thinking about it as well.
Are these guys getting individual attention as well? Dean, you obviously said that there's the core classes that they all come into.
Yeah.
Are yourself and the other coaches spending a bit of one-on-one time? Say if someone comes in, you're like, hey, we need to work on this wrestling. Are they getting that individual attention as well?
Yeah, of course. Depending on where they are in their phase of camp. Obviously, if they're in a fight camp, they're going to get more individual attention than if they're in off camp, because it's potentially less, you know, there's more need for that in terms of game plan, in terms of the specific things that you want them to be working on. And that needs to be done through either, you know, MMA pads working on game plan, or specifics around a particular area. So I'll definitely say in terms of attention, it's because we might have, say, in a fight camp, you might have only, you know, 10 guys in fight camp out of the whole academy. So then between myself and Richie, we would be able to split them and you know, we'd have our individual guys that we work with. So we're working with them over that fight camp. But then off camp, that's definitely less in terms of, that's more of a logistics thing than anything, I'd say. So we have to prioritize somewhat. And so we obviously made that decision to prioritize around fight camp for that one-on-one individual attention.
Yeah, Dean, the facility's been up for probably just over 12 months now, I think, if my timing's right.
Yeah.
What have you guys found competitively? Have you seen, you know, what did the numbers come back as? How have they been going since they've been training at the facility?
Well, pretty good. I'm pretty happy with them. We're all very happy with them, to be honest. We've got like a 93% win record. So I think we've gone something like 35-3, something like that. So we've been doing well in it. So in terms of you know, just, I don't know, just like realization of the theoretical stuff, because a lot of the stuff that we put into practice at the PI, I've never done anywhere else, because we've never had a situation where we've had everything under one roof. Some of what I've put together has been done in pockets, but never completely together. So to put that in place and have that, the theoretical side, into practice come with such positive, you know, results has been satisfied to say the least for the team. It's, you know, it's been really good, and you know, even the guys that have moved from the academy into the UFC have gone unbeaten. So it's definitely, you know, we feel like we're on the right track. Definitely not getting complacent, and we're still trying to always look at how we could be better, and you know, reanalyzing things, looking back, looking at debriefs, and looking at, could we have done this better? What was good about it? In that sort of post-transition time, after the fights, both with the athlete, we always have like a debrief. So they'll fight on the Saturday. On the Monday, they come back in. They'll have a debrief with the nutrition about, you know, the weight cut, debrief with the physical therapy to see, you know, what their injury status is. And then with myself about the fight and like a review about the fight. And then they get like 10 days off to just, you know, decompress, and they come back to it. So, but that review process is done with the athlete as well as the coaching staff for each individual athlete as well. So it's been, yeah, it's going well so far for sure.
Hey Dean, one of the, I guess, unique challenges that pops to my mind working in this environment is language. How have you guys handled getting around the language barrier, or is there even a language barrier, or how's that all work?
Yeah, no, that's the biggest, definitely our biggest challenge. There's no two ways about that. I worked in Japan for 3 years with a Kubota rugby team, and that was a massive learning curve for me in terms of my approach to coaching, and then making drills more implicit. So the outcome of the drill is what you're trying to get them to learn, rather than having to explain your way into it. So it takes out of the, obviously you can't do that with everything and you can't force that, but having a mindset of having a drill that's implicit helps in that situation when there is a language barrier and you're working through a translator. Because, you know, if you do value the importance of cueing, and whether it be internal or external cueing, and how what your approach is to that, and then you're then going through the filter of a translator who, and the heat of the moment, is trying to translate as quickly as possible in a class, there's you know, if you put too much on what you're saying, you're saying could be lost. So you can't emphasize that too much in terms of your coaching strategy, and you've got to look at other ways to approach that. So that has been, for sure, it's been a challenge. But we have, you know, we have Coach Paint, which is video analysis software that we can use to show things, which also, you know, helps you either often, you know, if there's a fight on the Saturday, Richie's kind of is the main person to take control of that, and he'll, you know, cut clips from fights, and we always have technical themes for the week that we're working on, particularly if you're in off camp, if there's anything within that technical theme of the week that we've seen on either in the on the weekend on the UFC, or we've created a database of stuff that, you know, like a folder of good cage footwork or good cage takedowns, you know, all these, we've got a library of all these techniques that we can then show Matt's side in relation to the technique that we might be showing. So using different methods of communication other than verbal communication to help the athletes learn is going to be like a multi-sensory approach, not just verbal, in terms of maximizing the way that these guys can learn. And it makes you a better coach for having to think like that. And in terms of the skill acquisition part of it, you know, a multi-sensory approach is better anyway, and it just emphasizes that even more when you have the language barrier.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. You just mentioned that there, Dean, the databases. Now, obviously, you guys have a crazy facility where you have the capacity to collect so much data. What are you guys doing with all of that? We were talking a little bit off air, and I know you can't give away too much, but you're putting all of that together in a journal, you're collating it all. What's the goal of the journal? What are you guys finding?
Yeah, so on the journal side, it's going to be, there's varying levels of sort of athlete, coach, and public interface in terms of the way we're communicating that data, and I think that the journal is not going to be as comprehensive in terms of the data. Although it's going to be bigger than the first journal, it's still, you know, one of the biggest challenges is actually what we're not going to put in it, rather than what we are going to put in it, because there's so much information that we could, you know, each department could do a journal on its own effectively. So Duncan has the you know, unfavorable task of editing all the work that we want to put in there, and, you know, reasoning with us about why, you know, let's cut this back, because at a later stage we are going to do an accreditation, we are going to do potentially a textbook and other forms of and like an online resource as well, where we really will go into the level of data that we that we're keeping both from the Vegas site and the Shanghai site. So the Shanghai is site, what's so interesting about the data that we have is that we have control of all the variables, or at least record of the variables that played into a particular outcome, whether it be, you know, a poor weight cut or not being fit enough and whatever it might be. And we can look back on, we know every session that athlete did, all his numbers in terms of S&C, all the technical work they did, how many rounds of sparring, all of that data is there. So we can use it in that respect, if we're trying to, in terms of the debrief and whatnot. But in terms of the journal, it'll be more about just trying to establish best practice, I guess the nomenclature that you're going to use around MMA, the different approaches that are there, what we've done in place in the Shanghai facility, and then also related to actual fight stats as well. There's aspects around fight stats in terms of what it takes to win, you know, strikes per minute, amount of control, all these factors that's constantly being collected around fights. And so it's more about sharing that information and giving coaches that are currently out there other approaches to the way that they coach, and maybe creating different questions in their programming and so forth, that they might take another approach, or they might think, oh no, that doesn't necessarily apply to me. But our overarching mission is to, you know, raise the level of knowledge around the sport of mixed martial arts. So that's going to be the main mission of the journal for sure.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the coolest things in like as a practitioner, one of the things I like most about the UFC and everyone that's involved with it, especially at the Performance Institute, is how open you guys are with the information. Like there's no secrets. I know in other sports, say like the NFL or NHL, it's kind of all kept in house.
Well, it's a different paradigm though, because if you think about the sport of mixed martial arts compared to NFL or whatever, where they're, you know, competing teams and so forth, the UFC isn't a team. The UFC is the sport in itself. And because of the individual nature of the sport, and how young the sport is, you think about the infrastructure that's around other sports like rugby or NFL, and they have all these teams that have a lot of money behind them that can have a team of support staff and so forth. For a team, even a team like ATT, which we basically only have one or two gyms that are at that sort of level, they still don't quite have the level that you would compare to like an NFL team, or so in terms of resources and whatnot. And so there's a logistical challenge to and a financial challenge to having that in place. So the UFC, by the UFC doing that, it's making everyone better. And it's not about competition. We're trying about, you know, share that information. Obviously, never sharing, you know, detailed information from gym to gym. That's a massive part of you know, the privacy aspect of it. But in terms of general principles around training, we're there to share, help, and assist. You know, these guys already know what they're doing. Any assistance that we could we can give them, we can. But if there's any research that we're, you know, numbers that are coming out, what we're doing in Shanghai or Vegas, then it's an opportunity to, you know, raise the level of MMA, because like you say, it's such a young sport. I think you mentioned it with Dunk as well, like, you know, my experience of rugby as well, I remember a time when rugby went into professionalism and the difference that it made to rugby. And I can see that parallel now with mixed martial arts, but the difference is it will take because of the nature of the individual sport, that will be difficult to happen, because you can't, you know, you can't get, it's not financially viable to have a team in the same way that's going to have pump those resources, because the teams aren't getting the ticket sales and so forth. It's not the same paradigm. So the UFC took it upon themselves for multiple reasons, but one of them being that, you know, if the athletes get better, the product's better. So everyone's a winner.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Dean, I am very aware of time at the moment. So last question, where do you see the UFCPI in Shanghai going in, say, the next 1 to 2 years, or maybe even further than that? Where do you see it all going?
Well, unfortunately, with, you know, everything that happened with the pandemic, we kind of got, you know, the momentum got taken out of our, or the air got taken out of our wings in terms of what the progression that we were making. But the plan was to have Dana White's Contender Series Asia filmed out of the PI, and we'd have the facilities, but we have production facilities available at the PI that will be just like pretty much like Apex, and we were going to be a platform for our academy athletes to fight other fighters from around Asia. So it effectively would have been China versus Asia, so Korea, Japan, and Thailand. And so, you know, we were very confident in under that setting that that was going to be one, the platform for our guys, academy guys, to get into the UFC, like a route for them. But we were also confident in their ability that would happen. So we would have had a lot more of our academy athletes in the UFC, which is on, you know, number one KPI. So we're hoping for, once things open up again, that will come back into place and we'll have that Dana White contender series, and that will sort of raise awareness about what we're doing in Shanghai, and that will kind of be the, you know, the target for the next few years is to raise the level of Chinese MMA, because there is an incredible amount of talent there. I've been super impressed with the number of guys that are out there that I'm confident that are, you know, there's a couple of guys in there that I've got championship level potential within them for sure. There's like two guys I would say that I'd already seen. There's what, you know, what one of the guys has got, you know, as much talent as I've seen in any athlete I've ever worked with. So, yeah, and they're constantly, you know, producing those athletes. And you think about, you know, historically where, you know, fighters have come from around the world. There's always some sort of, you know, socioeconomic challenge that they've come through to make a better life for themselves. Some of these guys are from like Inner Mongolia, Tibet, and so forth. And they come from really, really humble beginnings, and they're fighting for their family. They're fighting to provide for like, you know, their whole village. Like Alatang Haley won, you know, Fight of the Night bonus in his UFC debut, you know, came away $50,000, and that is life-changing money for his whole like village. So they're fighting, they're motivated on a different level, and so I'm super excited about giving those guys the opportunity for high-level training and raising the level of Chinese MMA and China being represented in the UFC as it should be. And I think that would be the legacy that we're hoping for the UFC PI to leave. And then we're also planning on, you know, multiple PIs around the world and continuing that, and then creating this, you know, global PI around the world, wherever those places may be. And you know, in you know, 2-3 years we'll have another one, and in 10 years maybe there's 5 PIs around the world, all producing, you know, high level talent under the sort of program that we've initiated right now through Vegas and Shanghai.
Yeah, absolutely, sounds brilliant and exciting times ahead. Now, Dean, people listening to this, if they want to get in contact with you, they say, oh, I've got 1,000,001 questions I want to ask him, but, you know, obviously can't get onto him. What's the best way for them to ask those questions? Do you have socials, email? What's the best way?
On social media, I'm just at Dean Amasinger, DeanAmasinger, on everything, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I don't really particularly use Twitter. I'm on there. I have a presence there, but I don't actually use it really. But and if anyone was to message me, then I'm happy to communicate. I enjoy it, and especially, you know, there's a lot of passionate people out there, I'm all about sharing the information that we're doing for sure.
Yeah, absolutely, I agree. Twitter is a very weird world, hey. But anyway, Dean, yeah, thanks so much for taking the time. I apologize for all the mixes up that we had in time zone, but we got it done.
No problem,
and that was
mate.
Such a great episode. So
thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Of course. All right, mate. We'll chat soon, okay?
Yeah, take easy.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Dean and the team at the UFC PI are revolutionizing mixed martial arts in every aspect. Dean and his team are methodically producing top quality athletes, and this is evident in the results they are producing in competition. Be sure to follow him on socials to stay up to date with his work. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.